This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I am delighted to talk to Jonathan Brown. You are most welcome, sir.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum assalam. Now, Professor Jonathan A.C. Brown is an American Muslim scholar of Islamic studies. He is the Al-Walid bin Talid Chair of Islamic Civilization in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And Jonathan has very kindly agreed today to tell us about Hadith. Now, he has published a critically acclaimed book entitled Hadith, Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and Modern World. And that's now into its second edition with additional chapters. I really recommend this book. It's an excellent introduction to a rigorously scholarly approach to Hadith. And I'll link to the book below if you want to get your own copy. So perhaps we can begin by asking some basic questions, Jonathan. What are Hadith?
Funny you should ask. So hadiths are reports about things that the Prophet Muhammad alayhi salam said or did, or things that were done in his presence and that he did not object to. Right. So the assumption being that if somebody did something in his presence, like ate a certain kind of food, and he didn't say, you know, don't eat that or you shouldn't eat that, that it's acceptable to eat that thing. So even things done in his presence are useful. Now, sometimes people talk kind of about the Quran and Hadith as these two foundational scriptures of Islam. And in a way, that's correct in the sense that, you can go and get the Quran off a shelf. It's in a book, and you can go and get books of Hadith and, you know, look at them and their texts and things like that. But I think it's more accurate to think about the foundations of Islam being the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet. The Sunnah of the Prophet, S-U-N-N-A, being his authoritative precedent, the authoritative precedent of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So the Sunnah is, as Muslim scholars have long written, I was just reading actually in the works of Shah Wali Allah, the famous Indian scholar who died in 1762, his definition, which is, I hadn't seen earlier, is the Sunnah of the Prophet is the infallible application of the Book of God. It's the Quran lived out and applied by the Prophet Muhammad. And that's why the Quran talks about sending down al-kitab wal-hikmah, the book and the wisdom being the Sunnah, in the sense that God inspires the Prophet with wisdom to apply the Quran's message in his life. Mm-hmm. And Sunnah can take the form of adding to the Quran, for example, adding rules, like, you know, the Quran says we can't eat, you can't eat, let's say, pigs. Whereas the Sunnah adds that we can't eat animals that have canines, that are predators, you know, so you can't eat lion meat or something like that. The Sunnah clarifies and explains the Quran. So the Quran says, you know, that the thief, male or female, cut off their hand as an exemplary punishment for what they've done. But we know from the Sunnah of the Prophet that this only applies to items that are above a certain value, in which that aren't certain things like foodstuffs or things like that. And also that the thief has to admit that they did this. If they just deny that they did it, or they thought it was theirs, then you won't have that punishment. It would drop down to a discretionary punishment. If you're interested in this, you can link to my article in Yaqeen about, it's called Stoning and Hand Cutting, which I think is a very important article. Yeah. So, you know, this is sort of the irony of people who are kind of, kind of Quran only, or only want to understand the Islam through the Quran, is that you would be left with having to punish any thief for, you know, stealing like a pen, you'd have to cut their hand off. Whereas this is absolutely not the understanding of Islamic law. And that explanation and clarification comes from the Sunnah of the Prophet. The Sunnah of the Prophet, so it can add, it can explain, clarify, it can restrict, and it can affirm the message of the Quran. Right. Now, the relationship between the Sunnah and the Hadith is sometimes people will get confused about this. Mm-hmm. Hadith are a way of knowing about the Sunnah of the Prophet. Now, you can think really about, Muslim scholars thought about the Sunnah in, you know, three or four ways. And they didn't talk about this so much. This is more my classification, but I think it's useful and I think it's accurate. First, they thought about it, you know, as hadiths, right? So if you wanted to know about the Prophet's precedent, how he acted, what he said, how he lived, what his judgments were, what principles he lived by, right? How he understood the Quran, you could just go back and collect as many reports about things he said and did and things that were done in his presence as possible. Mm. And then sort of like building a puzzle, try and figure out, okay, which piece fits with which, you know, what's something he said that was a general rule versus something he said that was for a specific situation, or what's something he said early on in Islam and then the rules changed later on, right? Or what's something he said that applies to one group of people and not to another group of people? Mm. What's something he said that maybe he was saying in a hyperbolic way, like he's preaching to people, so he's using kind of exaggerated language, versus something where he's being very legally specific, almost like a lawyer speaking. So, and of course, then, as I'm sure we'll discuss, there's the challenge of figuring out whether or not these reports are actually things the Prophet said or not, or if they were invented later on. But let's assume you could authenticate them all. You would have a bunch of pieces of a puzzle, and then you would be trying to fit these pieces of the puzzle together. And this is, in fact, what one of the main ways that all Muslim scholars, understood the Sunnah. The second way is to think about the Sunnah as a kind of a method of problem solving, a way of thinking, a way, if you think about maybe like the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law, this would be more like the spirit of the law. How would the Prophet deal with the situation? And you can see this very clearly, for example, in the practice of the early Muslim caliphs, like Abu Bakr and Omar, especially Omar, because he did so much legislating, that he would find a situation and he would sometimes, he wouldn't quote the Prophet, but he would come up with a rule that he thought kind of best implemented. This is what the Prophet would do in the situation. So, for example, he suggested when Muslims started to encounter lots of non-Muslims outside of Arabia, you know, he was like, you know, he said, I would discourage Muslim men from marrying non-Muslim women, because this is, you can see like, wait, you know, we were allowed to do this, but now it seems like there's going to be a problem of Muslim women not having enough men to marry. So we discouraged this. But that was, you know, you could see him sort of, how would the Prophet have acted in this situation? And what's interesting is you don't actually find a lot of hadiths from the very senior companions of the Prophet. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's because they died, you know, Abu Bakr died only 2 years after the Prophet's death. But people like Omar or Ali, Abdurrahman bin Awf, for example, who lived for a long time after the Prophet, you don't see as many narrations from them, nowhere near as many as you see from younger companions like Ibn Abbas, Ibn Omar, Anas ibn Malik, Aisha, right? Because those senior companions, they sort of lived the Prophet's Sunnah and carried it on, not by remembering specific things he said, but by like his personality had actually sort of imprinted on theirs. Like they had been shaped by their years with him, by their many, many years with him and constant contact with him. So, you know, one way you think about the Sunnah is hadiths. Now, the second way is kind of a method of problem solving. The third one would be a practice of a pious community that you know, the Muslim community that is built by Muhammad in Medina, actually its practice, its way of doing things. When you go into the mosque, what do you do? When you're standing for prayer, what do? Where do you stand? How far apart do you stand? How does the prayer, I mean, actually describing to somebody exactly how to do a prayer is kind of hard. You know, first you raise your hands up to this part of your hand, and you put them down here. It's kind of hard. It's a lot easier to show somebody how to pray. So the Sunnah of the Prophet as something that is just kind of practiced by the Muslim community. And of course, this is very, as you see this in all the Muslim schools of law, they all talk about this, but it's especially prominent in the Maliki school of law.
I was just going to say, absolutely. It is a really important quote from your book that I mentioned. You said, contrary to popular opinion, and this is an opinion I've heard mentioned in the media, both in America and elsewhere, the bulk of Islamic law does not come from the Quran, but from Hadith. This is remarkable. And you've already alluded to the way hadith, in a sense, qualify the rulings on cutting of a thief's hands, but there are many other examples. So the great bulk of it, of Islamic law, comes from the precedent of the Prophet and his teaching and so on?
Definitely. I mean, if you were to kind of look at just proportion of the details of Islamic law, I mean, a very small portion would come from the Quran. I mean, the Quran isn't really a book of law. One scholar, Ibn al-Amir al-Sanani, in the 1700s, I think he counted about 80 to 100 verses in the Quran that deal with legal issues. Wow. I think Imam Shafi talked about something like, I'm going to misquote it, so I'm just going to forget about that. But basic things like the number of prayers, how you pray. I mean, these are basic parts of the religion that are not really either explicitly or mentioned in the Quran or mentioned at all in the Quran. Definitely. And then this hadiths are a huge, if you're thinking about a consent, portions, let's say, of the Sharia, a very small portion would come from the Quran, and a big chunk would come from hadiths. Mm-hmm. And of course, there you have a spectrum, in the sense that there are certain hadiths that Muslim scholars kind of all agree are reliably traceable back to the Prophet, alayhi salam. There are certain hadiths that are not really reliable or not as reliable, but were really important for law, and that the main strength of those hadith isn't really that you could find a chain of transmission that goes back to the Prophet, narrated by all reliable people who met each other and et cetera, and has lots of corroboration, for example, that would make a hadith sahih or sound. But its strength really comes from its communal practice. For example, I mean, this is just an obvious example, but you'll find in books of law or hadith, that the murderer, al-qatil la yarith, the murderer does not inherit, right? Mm-hmm. So if somebody murders their dad, Quranically speaking, your son will automatically inherit from their father, right? It doesn't matter if the father doesn't like them. He can't, there's nothing he can do. Mm-hmm. But let's say, I'd like to get some money, so I'm going to go kill my dad and inherit. But if you murder somebody, you can't inherit from that person. And there's not really a reliable hadith about this, but you find in books of hadith and books of law that the Prophet said the murderer does not inherit. Mm-hmm. The strength of that hadith is really that it's been, this is, all Muslim scholars agree on this. This is sort of like its strength actually is comes from communal practice. So you see here like a blending of hadith and communal practice. Then, of course, a huge chunk of Islamic law comes from either the opinions of the companions of the Prophet, or from legal reasoning based on the Quran, based on the Sunnah of the Prophet, based on the early Muslim community. Either through analogical reasoning. So, women don't have to breastfeed when they're, you don't have to fast if you're traveling. You don't have to fast if you're sick. Therefore, you don't have to fast if you're breastfeeding. So this is an analogical reason. Right. Or of course, other types of reasoning, like what are the aims of the Sharia? What are its objectives? If we don't have any evidence from the Quran or the Sunnah of the Prophet or the early Muslim community, can we just sort of reason on our own to think about what would fulfill the aims of the Sharia? So these are all different sources of Islamic law, but definitely hadith are a major, major source.
Okay. Now, a natural question to ask is, how did Muslim scholars detect forgeries? Because I've heard that, particularly in the early centuries, it was like a veritable industry of pumping out forged hadiths to justify certain practices or certain political agendas or certain sectarian rivalries. So this became a problem really early on. So how did hadith scholars, the ulama, the Muslim scholars, actually go about detecting these problems? These forgeries.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Quran gets written down very early. So the Quran gets written down, in an official form by 650 of the Common Era. I mean, so you're talking within 2 decades of the death of the Prophet, and there's not really any debate about what the contents of the Quran is. There's not, some alternative version of the Quran that's out there that people are citing or something. People can argue till the cows come home about what the Quran means, but that's, as a source, it's sort of bounded and set in stone, so to speak. The hadiths are very different. And all those notions of sunnah that I talked about are very different because they're all, they all have strengths and they all have weaknesses. The strength of the kind of sunnah as a way of problem solving is that it's, as I said, it really kind of allows you to carry the spirit of the law into situations where the letter of the law is a little bit, is doesn't seem to apply. Or it's not giving you a clear answer. On the problem with that is that this, you know, spirit of the law reasoning can be, can kind of get out of hand. So you say, well, if, you know, if I'm allowed to not fast because of hardship, well, you know, it's hard to not drink coffee during Ramadan. Like I really feel terrible if I don't drink coffee. And so I kind of feel like I should not, that's sort of like what God wants in this situation. And that's not very good argument. Right.
No.
With communal practice, it's really sometimes, especially as you get farther and farther out of away from Medina of the Prophet's time in space and time, you know, what Muslims do, Muslim communal practice can become very dirty, you know, very polluted. And so you see people who say, you know, in my Muslim country, you know, men go out and play, you know, backgammon and drink shisha and smoke shisha, and women sit at home and cook. So that's the way Islam should be. Well, that's not the way Islam necessarily should be. That's just one particular country, right? So custom also is can be corrupted. With hadith, the problem was it's a great way to get a really fine, detailed description of things the Prophet said and did. The problem is that, one, as I said, you have to kind of be able to fit the pieces together. Yeah. But also, it becomes extremely clear in the time of the successors. So essentially by, you know, the late 600s, that lots of hadiths are being forged. And this sometimes it could be mistakes, right? So sometimes somebody would think they remember the Prophet saying something when in reality it's another companion saying something, right? Mm-hmm. Or sometimes somebody could just get confused and mix two hadiths together. And those are not necessarily forgeries. I mean, they are in effect forgeries in the sense that there was something the Prophet didn't say, but they're unintentional. They're byproducts of just the process of humans remembering and transmitting information. But then you have intentional forgeries that was done. Remember, Muslims, you know, within the first 140 years of Islamic history, Muslims fight three major civil wars. In addition, they spread from the Hejaz to Spain and India. And, you know, all the different cultures and religions and foods and clothing they encounter, and people are starting to become Muslim in North Africa and India and all these places. And of course, they're bringing their own traditions, their own questions, their own agendas into the mix. So you have political disputes, sectarian disputes, cultural disputes, legal disputes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what better way to advance your cause or your ideas than by saying that the Prophet of God said this or said that? So there's a huge, huge, huge engine of forgery that just starts chugging, especially in the early 700s. And that really keeps chugging hard through the 800s and even into the 900s of the Common Era, is I think when the bulk of this material is forged. Mm-hmm. So Muslim scholars have a challenge of how do you sort out what's authentic, authentically the words of the Prophet, and what's forgery. I'm happy to talk more about that unless you want to.
I'm just very interested because the role of this word isnad, a bit of technical jargon here. What is the isnad and the problem of forged isnads as well? But this idea of having reliable transmission from person to person, known people who could have met each other, did meet each other, who were known to be reliable, and so on and so on. There were various kind of checks that were made, weren't there, to see if, of this hadith and its alleged authenticity really was authentic. And this has become quite a serious academic scholarly pursuit, hadith criticism, you can call it.
Yeah.
And that produced ultimately these amazing, you know, book called Sahih Collections, Bukhari famously, and Muslim as well, which are the gold standard of hadiths today, which everyone now looks to for, you know, really solidly reliable hadiths. But that came quite late, didn't it? I mean, it was almost controversial, these Sahih collections. Before that, there weren't these Sahih collections. There were all sorts of different kinds of hadiths.
Yeah. I think a good way to think about this is that, you know, Muslims, all Muslim scholars, as Muslims develop their own scholarly class. So amongst the companions, there's companions who are seen as particularly knowledgeable, Aisha, Zayd ibn Thabit, Omar, right? Ibn Abbas, Ibn Mas'ud, Ali ibn Abi Talib. These are companions who really look to for their understanding of the Quran, of the Prophet. And then they teach the next generation of scholars in Medina, like Ibn Sa'id ibn Musayyib, Nafi', Kharij ibn Zayd ibn Thabit, Qasim ibn Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr in Kufa, people like Ibrahim al-Nakhai, right? Sha'bi al-Himyari in Egypt, in Yemen, in Syria. And then you sort of have the second and third generations, you really have these very clear scholarly figures emerge. And they're all presented with this problem, which is, okay, we have a huge problem, which is we don't know what is really the sayings of the Prophet and what isn't. And you can kind of think of a couple of different ways to solve this. One is maybe the way that emerges really clearly in Kufa, especially around the thinking of a scholar named Abu Hanifa, who dies at 157-67 of the Common Era, which is to say that, you know, in Kufa, you know, I remember also this is really important, which is that there's not like some internet, you know, there's not some book of hadiths you can go to the library in Kufa and check out, right? And there's no, if you're in Kufa, the way you know about Islam is because a bunch of Muslims showed up. Well, they built the city of Kufa, right, outside of Hira in Iraq. And the Muslims who happen to settle there are the ones who tell you about Islam. And if they remember certain things the Prophet said and they forget other things, and the guy in Egypt, the companions in Egypt, remember certain things the Prophet said and don't remember other things, you're going to have kind of two different versions of Islam in a way. And of course, they're not very different, but that's one of the reasons we have different schools of law is because you have this early plurality of remembering what the Sunnah of the Prophet is. So that someone like Abu Hanifa in Kufa, he's saying, okay, look, there's certain hadiths that we have here, and some of them really lay down clear principles. Really clear principles, like the Prophet saying that the person who benefits from something is also liable for it, or the person who is liable for something also benefits from it. That seems like a principle. And so when he comes across a hadith that doesn't seem to fit with that principle, or it seems to contradict it, Abu Hanifa, he might not say, I don't think the Prophet said this, but he just doesn't think this is representative of the Sunnah of the Prophet. So they try to kind of look at the Quran, look at the hadiths that they feel are kind of reliable in Kufa, and then extract from those sources some rules about lawmaking, about norms. And then those rules are definitive. And if you come across a hadith that seems to conflict with those, you just sort of dismiss it. It's probably not something the Prophet said. It doesn't make sense in the system they've established. Other scholars who are actually more concerned with theology, which is a group called the Mu'tazilites, which emerged in the kind of mid 700s, especially in Basra and Baghdad, later on in Baghdad. They're much more influenced by kind of theological discussions coming out of the Greco-Roman Near Eastern world of Christian theology, of Jewish theology, of Greco-Roman philosophy, where you have, you know, how do you get certainty in life? You get certainty through sense perception. You get certainty through the first principles of reason. You get certainty through just unambiguous, uncontested transmission. Like, you know, I've never been to China. I don't know if you've been to China. No. But I'm prepared to say that China exists, although I've never actually seen it. Right. We've just been bombarded with so much transmitted evidence that we don't doubt this. So they're much more concerned. These Mu'tazilites are much more concerned with like these debating with, you know, Christians or Jews and coming up with a way of sort of rooting Islam in epistemological sources that are certain and that are not going to carry any doubt. So they're very skeptical of somebody coming and saying, you know, so-and-so told me that so-and-so said that the Prophet said this. I'm like, for them, it's like a game of telephone. Now they understand the Sunnah of the Prophet is essential. They understand Mu'tazilites are Muslims, right? These are not people who are, you know, insane heretics or something, right? They're saying like, look, this is not really going to cut it. Right. This is not really going to cut it for what we want, especially for theology. Maybe for law, you could get something from these rules. But what they say is, if you really want to know that the Prophet said something, it has to agree with the Quran. It It has to agree with the established Sunnah as we know it. It has to agree with first principles of reason as we understand them. Mm. And this is a big deal, big difference. Yeah. And or it has to be agreed upon by everybody. And here is where you we get to the third group, the third approach, which is criticizing both of the previous ones. And this approach ends up being the Sunni approach, the approach that produces those hadith collections that you talked about, like Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. And what this group says, and it's forms around figures like Abdullah ibn al-Mubarak in Khorasan, Malik in Medina, Ibn Hanbal in Iraq, right? Sufyan al-Thawri, Sufyan in Kufa. What this group approach says is, look, here's a problem with these two approaches prior to this, which is that they both are setting up sort of standards for deciding what the Prophet said or didn't say that are too much the creation of their own worldview. Mm. Right. So they're putting their own minds in a way, their own minds in the position of being the judge of what the Prophet said or didn't say.
Yeah.
There's a problem here, right? Which, and this is a really good, I mean, they have a good point, right? Imagine this, if I tell you that, there's more women in paradise than men.
Hmm.
Or let me make it easier for you. If I tell you that there's more men in paradise than women, you're going to say, I don't think that's true. That seems kind of sexist. Like, that doesn't seem fair. You know, Islam's not sexist. I don't think that's fair. But actually, you have no idea. And you have no idea. Like, if someone's a prophet of God and God tells them information that comes from the unseen, for all we know, there are more men or more women in paradise, right? Like, we don't know. I mean, we can say like this seems sexist or not, but that's just us talking about what our values are. Yeah. So the problem is that there's certain, if we were to generally like sit around and evaluate things we hear, we could talk about notions of fairness or justice. But really, when it comes to things that are from the unseen, we actually don't know the answers. We don't know what the unseen is, right? So the reason is starting to get humbled here. Second, if, for example, if I say, well, hadith can't contradict the Quran, that makes sense. By the way, all Muslim scholars agree on this. But here's the problem, and this is what these Sunni scholars pointed out. They said, what's the difference between contradiction and explanation? If I say that, the Quran says that carrion, dead animals, has been prohibited for you. That's what the Quran says. Now, then we find a hadith that the Muslim companions of the Prophet find a dead whale washed up on the beach of the Red Sea, and that they eat from the meat of this whale. And then they come back and tell the Prophet they did this, and he doesn't object to it. This is fine. This technically contradicts the Quran, but nobody actually rejects this hadith. They see this as an explanation. Ah, the Quran is talking about land animals, not sea animals. In fact, we have other hadiths that also talk about the contents of the ocean being pure to eat.
Right.
So what's the difference between contradiction and explanation? How do you know when something is contradicting the Quran versus explaining or creating an exception to a Quranic rule or expanding a Quranic rule? The second, so they would say to someone like the Kufans, someone like Abu Hanifa, look, we understand you have these principles that you've derived from hadiths, and these actually might be good principles, but you're rejecting this hadith because you think it violates your principle, but actually it just might be an exception to your principle. Hmm. It might just be an exceptional situation the Prophet is making to this rule. The second objection they had, and this is more kind of to the Mu'tazilites, is the Mu'tazilites, for example, were very confident in the ability of human reason to come to knowledge about God and to come to knowledge about right and wrong, independent of revelation.
Hmm.
Now, the problem is that, as the Stanley Fish, the literary scholar, said, you know, reason always comes from somewhere. There's reason isn't, maybe there's certain basic fundamental things like the rule of non-contradiction. A can't be A and not A at the same time in the same way. Okay, that maybe everyone can agree on. But other forms of reason are really kind of culturally rooted or rooted in a certain tradition. So, for example, the Mu'tazilites they couldn't accept hadiths that talked about God moving around. Right. So this one verse, this one hadith in Sahih Muslim and Sahih Bukhari and other books says, God, the very late at night, God comes down to the lowest heavens and he listens to the prayers of those who are awake at night praying, right? Mu'tazilites just could not. This sent them into apoplectic fits because the God's moving around. What do you mean God's moving? If God's moving around, that means God's in a body. That means God's over here and he's not over here. So what's that? What is this shape? What is the shape of God? What is God's body like? How does God move around? Does he have like a scooter? You know, what's going on? I mean, they couldn't accept because they had been so much so influenced by the kind of Greco-Roman tradition of theology and of course philosophy.
Yeah.
That talked about, let's say Boethius talking about divine simplicity, that God can't be, you know, God can't be composite because something that's composite can come into parts. Then those parts could exist separate from him. And then you have things that are not God, that are eternal. Or the idea of motion in the Aristotelian cosmos, the prime mover, or in the kind of the theistic world, God is outside of creation. Anything inside of creation, inside the sphere of the fixed stars, is part of the world of change, of time, right? And something can't move around unless it's inside that world. You can't talk about movement outside of the sphere of the sphere of the fixed stars, because that's like another realm. Like God can't be moving around because that means he'd be part of our world, in effect. Now, okay, fair enough, Mu'tazilites, but what's all that got to do with Islam? I mean, you go back and you read, let's say, the Old Testament, and it's talking about God walking and God doing. I'm not saying that that's accurate, but my point is that clearly, you know, if you want to talk about like kind of a Semitic imagination, they do not have a problem talking about God in a language that is anthropomorphically inflected, at least metaphorically or figuratively so. And then the early Sunnis said to the Mu'tazilites, by the way, Mu'tazilites, you guys are not consistent because, look, you're Muslims. You believe in the Quran. We believe in the Quran. And the Quran talks about, you know, God and his angels in Surah Al-Fajr. God and his, I think it's Surah Al-Fajr, right? Ja'a Rabbuka wal Mala'ikatu Saffan Saffa. God and his angels come in ranks. They come in ranks. So God's coming in ranks with the angels. The Mu'tazilites say, yeah, but that's figurative. It's the power of God is coming. It's like, okay, if that's figurative, why don't you do a figurative interpretation for that hadith that you reject? Maybe it's not God's, you know, coming down. Maybe it's God's mercy coming down. And in fact, this would be the interpretation of later Ash'ari Sunni scholars. They'd say that it's not actually God coming down. It's the mercy of God or the knowledge of God coming, approaching to us. They were saying, if you look, you're willing to interpret the Quran figuratively when it seems to go against your ideas of reason, but you're not. But when it comes to hadith, you just throw it out. Why? So what the early Sunnis proposed is, if we want to figure out what the Prophet said and what the Prophet didn't say, we are saying that we're recognizing that human reason is a liability here. It means giving too much power to your own culture, to your own understanding of reason, to your own background assumptions. So let's try and take reason out of the equation, and let's just look at transmission. Let's see, okay, where did this material, who narrated this? Where did you get this hadith? Where did that person get the hadith? Where did that person get the hadith? Okay, let's look at these people. Let's look at what they transmit. If Paul, let's say, is narrating from his teacher, and he narrates, you know, A, B, C things. Then the other students of his teacher also narrate A, B, C from this teacher. It seems like these guys are all narrating the same thing, so, you know, they might be reliable. But let's say one student narrates F, G, L, M, N, O, P also from the teacher. And that student only studied with that teacher for 3 months or something, whereas you studied with him for 10 years. Whoa, wait a second. This student is claiming things from the teacher that are not corroborated by the other students. So once you start looking at what somebody narrates from their teacher, is it corroborated by other students of those teachers? You can start to decide, is that person a reliable transmitter? Once you've decided they're a reliable transmitter, you can say things that come from this person, from another person. And we say, this person met that person. They lived at the same time in the same city. They said, I heard this from that guy, right? Or that girl. Then these people become reliable transmitters. And through a process of evaluating the reliability of transmitters and then looking for corroboration or the lack of corroboration for reports, we can decide what are reliable hadiths of the Prophet and what aren't. And so that was the method that was developed really in the Hejaz and Iraq and Khorasan in the essentially late 700s to early 800s, and then really perfected in the mid 800s by scholars like al-Bukhari and Muslim and their students. And they produced a set of collections that, were fairly quickly appreciated, although not every collection was appreciated and valued in the same way at the same time. But especially Bukhari and Muslim's books really came to be seen as the pinnacle of the critical rigor of this process and seen as the most stringent book in terms of what authenticating what the Prophet said.
Yeah, and your PhD is actually on that very subject, isn't it? The Sahih collections of Bukhari and Muslim, which
how they attained that position.
Yeah, which is well worth getting and can be purchased. By the way, on this whole subject that Jonathan just mentioned, I do recommend his acclaimed book, Hadith, Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and Modern World, which I said before, I will link to below. It's really worth reading. Just something that really interests me in that book I've just mentioned. I often hear, by the way, that particularly from Christian missionaries, for some reason, I'm not sure why, that we have no hadith that can be traced back to the companions of the Prophet. Yet, in your book, you mentioned that we now have things called sahifa or sahifas, apostrophe S, if you add the English plural, which are kind of these small notebooks. And there's a fascinating story, I think, where I got a friend of mine who happens to be a Muslim scholar in the Hanafi tradition. And he said, when I spoke to him about this, that the hadiths used to be passed on, but are passed on orally in his tradition. And they have been like forever, for generations and generations. And then in your book, you mentioned that in the 20th century, an actual small notebook that ultimately traces its the words back to Abu Huraira, the companion of the Prophet, was actually physically discovered. And the contents of that actually are the same as the orally transmitted hadiths that my Muslim scholarly friend knew of from oral tradition. So this kind of an extraordinary opportunity, perhaps a rare one, to confirm, corroborate the reliability or the accuracy of oral tradition in handing down these hadiths. But could you just say a bit more about these sahifa, what they are and why, and that particular discovery in the 20th century?
Yeah. You're partially right. I guess in some ways I'm going to deflate some of your balloon, but I think you're generally on the right track, which is that, so first of all, the writing materials that the early Muslims had are very primitive and they're not very permanent. I mean, things like a parchment and papyrus are very expensive. Sometimes they would write on essentially like the bark of palm trees. You can kind of cut into sections and other sources as well. So, it was very expensive to write things down. And a lot of this material, there's a lot of movement, a lot of change, a lot of early material doesn't really survive. We have some, pages of Mus'hafs of the Quran that come from extremely early, from maybe even the lifetime of the companions of the Prophet, definitely from the lifetimes of the companions of the Prophet, certain pages of the Quran. But when it comes to hadiths, we have, there are certain hadith collections that have, so there's two questions here, right? So one is, when are hadith written down in a more systematic way? And the second question would be, how confident can we be that a later book claiming to be accessing those early written collections is actually is that a sound claim?
Yeah.
Okay. So, in terms of Muslims writing stuff down, we know they're writing small things down because at least as far as we can tell, they're talking about like a letter that the prophet, let's say, wrote to the people of Yemen. He writes a letter that that contains rulings about compensation payments for injuries. And that letter is then transmitted in a family, like from a dad to his son, right? There's other reports that are, that claim to be the sahifas, sort of notebooks, that are basically written. I mean, you can imagine you have one piece of parchment. Okay, you have one sheet of parchment, which is actually, you know, you can wash and like this, these things are pretty rugged as long as you don't let it rot or something like that. So you could imagine like a companion of the prophet and his son or children writing down things the prophet said on this rules he said.
Yeah.
And then this actually being handed down in a family.
Yeah.
This is what a good example of this sahifa of the Amr ibn Shu'ayb, which goes ultimately back to the companion Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As from the Quraysh. And you can see, like, you can, in some hadith collections, like the Musnad of Ahmad ibn Hanbal, you actually see a quotation of this sahifa almost in its entirety. Like, it's just a bunch of rules. And sometimes they're not even connected. It's just like rule, 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 rule. Clearly, from what we can tell, Muslims start to write things down very early, but these are very limited writings. They're not systematic. They're like done by a family or a person in a family, and they kind of pass on in that family. Abu Huraira, the companion of the prophet who narrates the most hadiths from him, actually only knows the prophet for about 2 or 3 years. He mostly is hearing other hadiths from other companions things that the prophet said. And there are reports that he actually is also collecting and copying these sahifas that he can find.
Right.
Now, we have one such sahifa, the sahifa of Hammam ibn al-Munabbih from the student of Abu Huraira. But we don't have like Hammam's written version. We have one that can be dated back to the early 800s.
Right.
So let's say that would be about 70 years or so after Hammam's death.
I see.
Maybe it's the original, but we can date it back to that original. Now, that's not surprising, right? Because if you want a book to survive, anything to survive, you can either put it in like a vacuum, whatever, sealed bag or something, right? But I mean, eventually it's going to get worn down into pieces. And so, especially if people are using it. So you need to recopy it.
Yeah.
So that gets us to the, we have actual physical pages of hadith collections or of people's written compilations of hadith from the mid 700s, from the late 700s, from the 800s.
Right.
Really going back to like kind of the mid 700s is probably the earliest actual physical copies of things we have that have survived.
Right.
Okay. Now, in the time of the younger successors, so around, let's say, the early 700s, successors like Az-Zuhri, Sa'id bin Abi Uruba, start to write down hadiths more systematically. So now they're actually writing down more things they hear. They're actually trying to write down a lot of their hadiths that they hear. They're not just trusting that they're remembering them. It's not just sahifa from their family. They're actually trying to collect and compile, but they have very small amounts of material. Their scrolls are about like, you could carry it in their saddlebags on their camel. It would be no problem to do that. Whereas by the time you get to like Ibn Hanbal, in the mid 800s, I mean, his library of hadith is like 12 and a half camel loads of books. Because by that time, by the time you get to late 700s, Muslims have gotten paper, the technology of paper, which is cheap. And you can write as much stuff as you want, right? It's not, you don't just have like a small amount of papyrus or a small amount of parchment that you can write on. Okay, so we have texts like from the late 700s in actually the texts themselves dating back from the late 700s, but very limited. Now, then the final question is, if you have later books, later actual physical copies, you can date to like the 1000s or something, or the 900s. or the late 800s. To what extent can you be confident that they're actually reproducing things from earlier? There, you know, you have to look at the works of scholars like Harold Motzke, the late Harold Motzke. I think he died in about 2014, if I'm not mistaken, where he's looked at a lot of these, what's early Musannafat books, which are basically books organized by topic. The Musannaf Abdurrazzaq Sanani, who died, I think, around 827 of the Common Era, Ibn Abi Shayba, who died in the 840s, of the Sirah of Ibn Ishaq. And what he's done by looking at all these different sources and sort of saying, okay, these people are claiming to narrate from a common link, and they all sort of narrating the same thing. And then these other people are also narrating from the earlier generation. They all kind of agree. And then you start looking, you're saying, look, here's a version of the report that has, you know, the content has, let's say, A, B, and C in it. Hmm. And it's transmitted along certain paths. And there's another version that has B, C, and D in it. And that's transmitted along certain paths. And if you look, you don't see A on this path over here. So you're seeing that the contents of reports are really consistent with the chains that they're getting transmitted by. So, and then maybe also some of those transmitters are saying things like for example, Az-Zuhri or his student, Allahumma salli Muhammad, like his student, Ibn Juraj or something, right? They'll say, I don't know what this word means, or I don't understand what he meant by this. Or they'll transmit something that disagrees with what they think the correct idea is. So why would somebody make up something and then say, like, I don't understand what he meant by this, or this is what he said, I don't know what the word means, or it actually disagrees with my opinion. So all these things together that I mentioned gave Motzke a sense of confidence that you could date specific reports, not necessarily the entire Hadith corpus, but you could, if you start just looking at individual reports, you could start to date them back to the late 600s of the Common Era, kind of the time that they're actually still companions of the Prophet alive, wow, like Anas ibn Malik. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, is the, it doesn't help you say that Sahih Bukhari is 100% accurate or the Muwatta of Malik is 100% accurate. But what it does tell you is that Muslim scholars were able to accurately transmit material from the very early period. And by the way, what's interesting is that a lot of times when they are, let's say, when errors or misinformation or forgeries are entering into this, sometimes it's, Muslim scholars are aware of it, and sometimes they were, you know, not necessarily averse to it. And I'll explain that in really quickly, right? So for you to say that, for somebody to say, you know, is everything in Sahih Bukhari true? Did the Prophet say everything is in Sahih Bukhari? Well, I mean, the answer is no, but the question is wrong, right? The question is wrong because there are, in Sahih Bukhari, let's say, sometimes 5 or 6 different versions of one hadith narrated by different chains of transmission, and they might differ in details. You know, one says the Prophet prayed 2 prayer cycles before he did this. The other one said the Prophet prayed the 2 prayer cycles after he did this. Which one is correct? They might all have authentic chains of transmission. Is somebody just misremembering something? Are both of them actually remembering something, but they were on different occasions? Did someone in the chain of transmission get confused? So Bukhari himself will like talk about this, and later scholars will talk about this, but they can't, in one sense, they can't both be true in a sort of digital sense of like, you know, either right, wrong, right. But they're all like, they're definitely giving you the most accurate possible picture of what people remember about the Prophet's sayings and his actions. The second thing is that a lot of these reports that people are very suspicious about, and you can, I mean, if you gave a list of the hadiths that, you know, that people get upset about being in, let's say, Sahih Bukhari or Sahih Muslim, you could pretty much say that they all come from certain chapters of those books. They all come from chapters about the beginning of time, the end of the world, the day of judgment. They come on things about like campaigns of the prophet, things that happen out on campaign, the virtues of people, like such and such a person is so good because of this, right? And those are topics that as far as we can trace back the science of Sunni Hadith criticism, Sunni Hadith scholars were saying, Hadiths that deal with law, ahkam, halal and haram, how you worship, how you fast, what you can eat, what you can drink, right? What they saw as the core areas of the religion. They were very strict about the isnads for those. They said on other issues, like the virtues of people, what happens at the end of time, what happens at the beginning of time, you know, the rewards you get for certain actions, et cetera, manners, du'as you make, right? You know, invocations you make. They said, we are lax about this because they didn't see this as core issues. And, you know, like, okay, Moses was so great that he did this. We know Moses is great already. He's a prophet. You know, was he this great or that great? I mean, it doesn't matter. The prophet said that it's really good to teach your children good manners. We know it's good to teach your children good manners. That's not changing anything. You know, if teaching your child good manners gets you this reward in the day of judgment, as opposed to that reward, that's a sort of not really a big deal for them because it's not changing anything that they don't already know. Hmm. So that's where a lot of the, sometimes not so much in like Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim, but certainly in the other collections, a lot of the material that people find problematic is actually in subject matters, subject areas that Muslim Hadith critics themselves were admittedly lax about because they didn't see it as detrimental. They didn't see themselves as betraying the Sunnah of the Prophet in doing this.
Okay, that's very helpful. But perhaps finally, my final question, as you've been discussing this for nearly an hour now, is to do with the Western historical critical method. You mentioned briefly Harald Motzke, this very esteemed German scholar who just died a couple of years ago, hugely influential figure, a Western scholar, non-Muslim, I think. I assume he was non-Muslim.
Yeah.
But in terms of historical critical method, which is distinct and separate from the Muslim Hadith critical method, what assumptions does the Western historical method make about the world and about God? And how does this impact on Western discussions about the historical reliability of Hadith? Because it tends to produce quite different conclusions, I think, in terms of what is and isn't accepted in the Hadith.
So if you want to share with your audience, there's on yaqeeninstitute.org, there's the, I think it's basically a sample from my Hadith book, and I added material as well. I think it's called Blind Spots. If you look up kind of on Yaqeen Institute, something called Blind Spots, it's essentially the chapter of my Hadith book on historical critical method that I actually also add material to. So sort of like an enhanced chapter. And this will be good for your readers or your viewers if they want to learn more about this. The way that, if you think about how like we in the kind of modern West think about what's true and false in history, what's true and false about religion. This is not an objective methodology. You know, human beings don't drop out of the womb and automatically view the world the way a French person views the world today, right? Or an American person views the world. These are specific traditions they come from. And if you look back at the way that, that Western scholars approach not just their own religion, but also Islam, and kind of questions of authenticity and reliability, you see how it's shaped by the specific experience of Western Europe with Christianity in the classical Greco-Roman tradition, essentially from the Renaissance until the modern period.
Right.
Just briefly, I mean, a few things that are really important are there, the discovery in the 1500s, 1600s, and 1700s, that there are a lot of gospels that had totally different understandings of Jesus's message that didn't make it into kind of the official Christian corpus. Second, that the early church, Christian church, introduced a lot of ideas that were not present in the earliest material we can date back to, let's say, the Christian community or Jesus or, you know, et cetera, right?
Yep.
Third, that the Old Testament itself was not the product of, you know, let's say the five books of Moses were not written by Moses, but in fact were the product of multiple authors in different contexts with different aims.
Yeah.
So a couple of assumptions just that we can talk about quickly, and I think your viewers would benefit from reading the Blind Spots article. I think if they're interested in this.
Yeah.
And I think these are the ones that kind of end up being the most influential in the way Western scholars talk about Islam today. Not all Western scholars, some Western scholars, is that there is this absolute conviction that religion change. So what the original Christianity, the original message of Jesus was not what eventually ended up being expressed in the four canonical gospels of the New Testament. Right. So that's sort of, that becomes in some ways like an article of faith by the late 1700s and the early 1800s amongst Western academic scholars of religion. And then later on, even by pious believers of those religions in some ways. Not all of them, but some of them, right? So this idea that orthodoxy is a historical creation, and then orthodoxy goes back and changes what came before it to make it look like it wanted history.
Yeah.
So create a sacred history.
Yeah.
That scriptures can't be intact because the Bible is not intact. So, you know, no other scripture, you know, just scriptures are doctored, they're forged, they go through changes. Orthodoxy is a later creation. It goes back projects its own vision of the religion and history onto the past. And so they just assume this is the case for Islam. Now, there may be aspects of this that are true. I mean, this is a big discussion. I mean, there's clearly aspects of different schools of Islamic theology that are later developments and not necessarily identifiable in the early Islamic period.
So okay, you mentioned the Mu'tazilites, who said were Muslims, and obviously they're influenced by Hellenistic philosophy and their interpretation of Hadith. Presumably that doesn't go back to the original community.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, precisely. This is what they were criticized for, right? Now, however, what this ends up with kind of bizarre situations where, you know, if you remember a few years ago when the Birmingham Library, Birmingham University found these pages of the Mushafs of Quranic pages they had that they carbon dated back to like the time of Abu Bakr.
Yeah.
Right. And then you saw some of these scholars, like I think Gabriel Saeed Reynolds is one of them, a very kind of skeptical scholar at Notre Dame. He's like, this can't be right. This must be later. Right. And then it came out that actually the range of dates could have been as early as like the 550s or something, like before the life of the prophet. Yeah. Then Gabriel Reynolds was like, but it could be from the 500. So wait a second. It has to be either later or it's earlier than the prophet. Why not from the prophet's lifetime? I mean, why is that such a great look? You can think, you know, non-Muslim scholar we're talking to, you don't have to believe Muhammad was a prophet. You can believe he was a total fraud. You can believe he made up the whole Quran, right? You know, that's your opinion. But what's so crazy about saying that the Quran comes from his time? I mean, why is that such a ludicrous idea? But it's almost like you can see this is almost a tentative
thing. It's like a reflex that they push it to the extreme, but not the obvious thing, which is, well, maybe it came from his own lifetime. Why not? You know?
Yeah. There's just this obsession with that. Or, right. You know, the thing is like, you know, you have just the other day, it's really funny. I mean, around the time that the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan, and I think it was August or September of this year. And there was, you know, there was this headline. It was like U.S. leaves Bagram Air, leaves Afghanistan in middle of night. You know, it was like BBC headline, right? You go back a couple of years, the Onion comedy newspaper had a headline from, I think it's 2019, U.S. leaves Afghanistan in middle of night. You know? How do you know something is made up? Like, you know, sometimes it's, you know, yes, like you could make up something based on historical fact, but sometimes it's not clear what comes first, the historical fact or somebody imitating historical fact, right? So a good example of this is like the in the when the Quaker, I think his name's Thomas Naylor or something, this Quaker kind of leader in Britain in the 1600s, he enters, I think, the city of Bristol, and he enters it on a riding a donkey, and people are like throwing palm fronds in front of his follower. So, like, okay, what if you were okay, that's according to like the way Western scholars think about Islam and Islamic scripture, right? What that would mean is that that guy's followers then wrote something in the Bible that talked about Jesus entering Jerusalem while riding a donkey with people throwing palm fronds in front of him. So they would go back and doctor scripture to make it sort of prefigure or presage this leader's entrance into Bristol in the city in the 1600s. But of course, that's ludicrous because we know that the Bible, I mean, whatever the authenticity of the Bible is, it definitely comes from way earlier than the 1600s in Britain, right? Yeah. So what's happening here is Thomas Naylor, I forget his last name. I think it's Naylor. If I'm wrong, you can correct it in the
I'm sure
box underneath or whatever, which is that what he's doing is he's acting out scripture.
Yes.
So like in the case of hadiths, there's a hadith that talks about the prophet talking about the black banners will come from the east, like the kind of the Mahdi, the Messiah will come, the messianic figure will come from the east in Khorasan and carrying black banners. Now, the Abbasid Caliphate, the Abbasid Revolution started in Khorasan, and their colors, their banners were black, their uniforms were black. The Abbasid Caliphs all wore black, right? So what scholars, Western scholars would say is that this hadith was invented to kind of legitimize the Abbasid movement as like this messianic movement, bringing justice and filling the world with justice as it had been filled with injustice. Okay, that's possible. But it's also possible, like this Quaker fellow in the 1600s in Britain, that there's an existing hadith that talks about black banners coming from Khorasan that maybe the prophet actually said. And so the Abbasids are like, hey, like, what color are we going to wear? It's like, I know, well, we'll wear black because of this hadith and we'll get like banners. Well, you know, they might have actually structured their movement in part around that hadith. So which comes first, you know, the chicken or the egg? Or that's not a good example because that's a conundrum. But which comes first, the scripture or the imitation, or the reality creating scripture or scripture shaping reality? Mm-hmm. In the Western kind of presumption or bias is that scripture and religion is always being doctored to fit to the present or the desire.
It's a very kind of skeptical, suspicious methodology that's never quite taking, you know, if a prophet actually is a prophet and predicts things in the future, I mean, from an Islamic point of view, that's kind of automatically discounted because, hey, we're suspicious Westerners and we don't believe that God acts in the world anyway, and there aren't real prophets that God speaks through and make actual predictions that actually come true. So there's a whole worldview here which is suspicious, looking for ulterior motives, looking for are the post facto creations and, you know, retrofitting narratives. And it's a very kind of conspiratorial.
I would say that it's kind of, it's conspiratorial and skeptical beyond even what their own premises would call for. What I mean is that, okay, Western scholar, I know you're not Muslim. I know you don't believe the Prophet Muhammad was a prophet. That's fine. I understand. Okay. But you got to admit that even somebody who thinks they're a prophet or who says they're a prophet is going to do things like prophesy, right? They're going to say there'll come a day when X happens, right? So let's say, and if they did that and that there are these prophecies they made that are known in the community, it's entirely possible that the Abbasids, let's say, would shape or tailor, literally tailor their clothing to fit that prophecy, right? So, you know, even like we're not even asking, I'm not asking that non-Muslim scholars all accept prophets and all accept revelations. So like, no, but you know, sometimes the skepticism goes beyond even what's called for by their own premises, their own sort of starting points, to the point where sometimes it becomes more insane to believe what they're proposing than just to believe that like the prophet actually said something. Like the prophet clearly said something in 23 years of being a prophet. Like he didn't just sit there and not say anything for 23 years, right? But you'll find people like Patricia Crona saying, you know, essentially every hadith cannot be assumed to be true. I mean, I don't understand. Like, what, you know, you want me to believe that all this stuff was made up, you know, or as in my, I wrote an article about this. I think it's on my webpage about Tom Hollins and his In the Shade of, Sword, right? Where he has this idea that the five daily prayers actually comes from Zoroastrianism in like the 700s. Mm. And his evidence is like a Zoroastrian guy talking about how Zoroastrian converts still like to drink after they become Muslim. Okay.
So, Tom Holland's a British historian and must be very respectful towards British historians. However, your debate with him, which you can see online, I think it's even on YouTube or something, absolutely hilarious. And the way you kind of unpicked and demonstrated the really extreme lengths he goes to avoid the obvious is almost, I almost found it almost funny because.
I mean, the fact of the matter is like, look, the Quran says that Islam is building on existing religious traditions. Mm. It literally says that, right? So is it that crazy to think that Muslims have these five daily prayers? I mean, maybe they got, who knows where it came from, but the point is, this is what God and the Prophet commands, right? And is it that crazy to think that Muslims, why does everything have to be made up later on? Why does everything have to come from like some Zoroastrian conspiracy in the 700s?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is just...
Yeah, I know with Tom Holland, he's very respectful to people like Tom Wright, former Bishop of Durham, and very ultra-conservative Christian scholar. I mean, he's a great Christian scholar, Tom Wright or N.T. Wright. So he's kind of, he's very kind of accepting and sympathetic towards that kind of biblical Christian methodology when it comes to the Gospels and their historicity. But when it comes to Islam, there's a very different kind of methodology and dare one say skepticism to do with the sources there. So there's a slight inconsistency, I would suggest.
Yeah.
Perhaps we can draw that to a conclusion there. I've been absolutely fascinating, Jonathan. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. You mentioned several items we can look to for further reading, the blind spots, and there's other articles, and I'll link to those below. But I also want to mention one of my favorite books, which is this, Misquoting Muhammad, The Challenge and Choices of Interpreting the Prophet's Legacy, which also covers all of these subjects, the early hadith, the community, the Quran, so much material. I won't even go into it, but this is a really excellent general book, Introduction to Islam for the General Reader. So I recommend that very much as well. So in conclusion, Jonathan, is there anything you wanted just to say in summary before we conclude?
I mean, I'm grateful for your work. I follow it. I enjoy it. And thank you. Keep doing what you do. People like me enjoy and benefit from it.
Inshallah. Well, thank you for your incredible work. I always ask, I try and always remember to ask the scholars I have on, are you working on anything particularly now, or have you just produced any work that we might?
Yeah, I just finished a book. Actually, I'm just doing the last read through right now of Islam and Blackness, which is kind of a coda to my previous work, a book, Islam and Slavery.
Yeah.
And Slavery and Islam, and then Islam and Blackness. And then after that, I have to finish the book that I have sitting on the back burner, which is almost done. I've been on the back burner for now almost 7 or 8 years on justice and Islamic law, legal reform, right? So it's basically about how Muslims conceptually and institutionally deal with instances in which their kind of law, body of law, and expectations of justice don't match up.
Mm. Mm. Fascinating. Good. Well, so that book on Islam and Blackness, is that due out imminently? Is that to be published this year?
Yeah, I'll submit it in, you know, once I'm done, literally the pile of paper right behind my computer. Once I'm done reading that, I'll send an email to the publisher, and then they'll get it out whenever, probably, I think, in the fall is my guess, inshallah.
Okay, interesting. I look forward to that. Well, once again, thank you so much, sir. And as always say, until next time, and thank you very much for your expertise today.
My pleasure. Assalamu alaikum.